Well, hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and I want to extend a warm welcome to all of our Tenpenny Files premium members at this that is found on Podbean. You can find the direct link to at drtenpenny.com, which also links up to all of our educational programs, our newsletter, and all of our remaining social media links. Today, we're going to have a deep dive with a conversation with a very special guest about what inspires him and what moves him to be who he really is. Let me introduce to you today our special guest, Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. McCullough is an internist, a cardiologist, an epidemiologist. He's currently in Texas. He has a long list of credentials, but nobody can explain his background better than he can introduce himself. So Dr. Peter McCullough, welcome to the Deep Dive with Dr. T. Tell people a little bit about who you really are.
Well, thanks for having me, Dr. T. It's certainly an honor to be on the program with you. I'm a practicing internist and cardiologist. I'm a medical doctor. I do non-invasive cardiology. I'm also a trained epidemiologist, and I split my time between seeing, caring for patients, mainly in the clinic. I am on call for patients in the hospital and see patients in the hospital. And I also spend the other half of my time in academic work. So I'm the editor-in-chief of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine, as well as the editor-in-chief as Cardiorenal Medicine. I have my first textbook that's just came out called Cardiorenal Medicine, where I'm the editor. It's the inaugural edition. And I'm very active in the field of clinical science. I'm the chairman of data safety and monitoring boards for the National Institutes of Health and a variety of pharmaceutical and device manufacturers. I've worked with probably at least four different divisions of the National Institutes of Health and at least three or four different divisions of the US FDA. I've been very involved in the development of in vitro diagnostics. I've been involved and directly involved in the direct development and approval of about 13 different drugs on the market. And I can tell you, I have been extraordinarily changed over the course of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's really influenced me professionally and I'll let you take it from there.
Well, go ahead and go with that. I mean, how has this changed you? I mean, before you go into that, I just want to make a comment because I'm an osteopathic physician. My first career, I was director of a level two trauma center, emergency medicine doc, director of a level two trauma center for 12 years. And I moved to Cleveland, and have had my integrative holistic clinic now since 1996. And whenever I speak to someone like yourself who has this long list of credentials and have done all of these things, I just can't imagine how you packed all of that into, your life. And you're obviously not that old. And so how does one maneuver that? And how is, if there were young people listening to this and were wanting to go to medical school, and what would you say to them about being able to be both a clinician and an academician like you've become?
Well, what I'd say is that if one can develop the ability to always put the patient first and to take a genuine interest in the patient, then everything else will flow. If a physician finds a patient who's genuinely interesting and you're compassionate in the care, all the other questions will come. And so as I see and examine patients, each and every patient for me, I learn something. So when I go to work, and I'm starting my fourth decade of doing this, when I go to work every day, I want to come home learning a little bit more. It's called lifelong learning. And that's what I really committed my career to doing. Sure. Does it mean long hours? Sure. Does it mean working 7 days a week? Absolutely. Does it mean having no barriers between work and personal life? For me, there's no barriers. It's a complete blend. And I've been able to do that over the course of my career and stay healthy, have a healthy marriage and family. But it had to do with this idea that I'm not working, that my employment or my job, if you will, is so enjoyable and so compelling that it's not work, that I would do it anyway. If there was no money in it, I'd still do it anyway, because it is just what it is. It's right here, right now. And in fact, I feel even to a greater conviction of this with this global crisis going on.
And how has this changed you? You started down that path. What has changed your whole career, changed you internally through this process?
I grew up as a kid. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, and during one of the economic downturns, my dad lost his job, and our family really went on the scramble financially. And so we packed up the car one day, we lost our house, we lost everything, and we headed to Texas. And when we crossed the Red River, we literally, landed in a motel. And my dad found a job, and so we started. That was our address when we started high school. And so we basically, from that time, it's interesting that when you're brought down to nothing and then you rebound, you can rebuild. And so my claim to fame, if I have one, is that every dollar I've ever earned in my life since age 12, I earned. And every dollar I ever spent, I earned myself. Every dollar I spent over the course of my life that I earned. And I helped, fortunately, was able to help others. So I went to high school in BART in Wichita Falls, Texas. I graduated from Grapevine High School. I was blessed to get a scholarship, patchwork of scholarships and Pell Grants and other things to attend Baylor University. I attended Baylor and then from there launched, I got in off the waiting list to UT Southwestern. So I knew I was the last dog to get into Southwestern. And I can tell you, I finished number one in my class on the clinical rank, and I finished number 12 overall. I was an Alpha Omega Alpha graduate. I launched from there to the University of Washington in Seattle, which is, in my view, probably the top place to train in medicine. While I was at Southwestern, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was won. When I was in Seattle, the Nobel Prize in Medicine was won. I was really fortunate to ride the peak of science there. And then what I did in Seattle, this is a long time ago, but this is what people did 30, 40 years ago, is when we finished residency, it was common to do service. Many people became officers at the Centers for Disease Control or went into the military. So I did service, and I did 3 years as a rural health physician, and I was assigned in northern Michigan. So I was worked as a general practitioner. Myself and a fellow from Duke, Chuck Williamson, we were stationed together, and we managed everything for basically a three-county region. I think it was 40,000 people, thousands of people in our clinic, and we had helpers, but the doctors were the premium. We managed everything. And so that rural medicine period of my life, I think, made me like an osteopathic physician or made me like a naturopathic physician. It made me have to solve problems without all the support of the ivory tower, without all the intellectual backup that we were going to be handed guidelines and randomized trials that I literally had people I had to take care of. Some patients would come to my house on the weekends. The hospital wasn't open. They'd actually show up at the door. My wife would make them a cup of coffee. I'd have to solve problems in my living room with patients. And so I learned through the course of that time that there's many, medicine is clearly an art and a science. And anybody who just tries to say it's a science, let's wait for randomized trials and not think it's an art is absolutely nuts. Medicine is an art and a science. And I always prided myself on being an extremely good clinician. I was the best in my class in Southwestern Medical Schools, one of the top 20 medical schools in the United States. I had a very good start. So from there, I went to the University of Michigan School of Public Health. I trained in epidemiology. What I realized is I could not interpret the medical literature. I didn't know what all these statistical operations were. I didn't understand epidemiologic principles. I didn't understand clinical trials. Well, I went to one of the best schools of public health and got the best training I possibly could. Then I launched my career, and I was going to actually just stay at University of Michigan and do my fellowship. It was very interesting. There was an iconic figure at University of Michigan. His name is William O'Neill, and he had an idea that for a heart attack, instead of just letting people gut out the heart attack, which was the standard of care back in the 80s, that we could go in and get the artery open. And at about that time, clot-busting drugs called thrombolytics were being developed. And O'Neill had a rift with the University of Michigan and had an idea that he needed to get to a hospital that could actually move more quickly and freely and work in clinical trials. So he went to William Beaumont Hospital, and he was there just a few years. And this is in Michigan. And he recruited myself and like-minded people. And within a few short years, we had William Beaumont ranked number 11th in the United States in cardiovascular care. And we were just a community hospital. We took William Beaumont Hospital to being the busiest hospital in the United States. more admissions and discharges, the biggest cardiovascular center in the United States. And we started doing clinical trials and we are knocking it down. New England Journal of Medicine, one by one. The first paper I ever published was New England Journal of Medicine. And we proved to the world that it was better to open up an artery to treat myocardial infarction as opposed to giving thrombolytics. And we went up against the Cleveland Clinic and Harvard, and everybody else was against us. Oh, you can't do this. You can't do this. And we were like, yes, we can. And our team was Beaumont, was Moses Cone Hospital, North Carolina, Riverside Hospital in Columbus. We had community hospitals of like-minded people who were committed to the science of clinical trials, and we proved to academia a better approach, and we literally changed healthcare. So that's where I got going with Beaumont Hospital. From there, I had leadership positions at Henry Ford, a wonderful place to work. I have a fond memories of Henry Ford. I was recruited to be chief of cardiology at University of Missouri in Kansas City. I'd probably still be there today, but because of family and other issues, I returned to Detroit. I became a division chief back at Beaumont Hospital. Beaumont Hospital became so big and so prolific, it became the Oakland University Beaumont School of Medicine. You know, it's almost, it followed the way that Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic did. Beaumont became really a terrific medical school. And different than Cleveland Clinic and Mayo Clinic, Beaumont had the volume. I mean, people don't understand what we had. Beaumont had volume that crushed these other centers. And then from there, I became the chief academic scientific officer for Ascension Health in the division, St. John Providence division. I learned in administration that contracts don't last forever. Administrators change jobs. So I came to the end of a contract. And fortunately, I'd been recruited for several years to come to Baylor in Dallas. And a very prominent physician was in my position. His name is Clyde Yancey. And Clyde Yancey, in my position at Baylor, my former position, was recruited to be the president of the American Heart Association. Then he went on to be chief of cardiology at Northwestern. He left. I joined Baylor University Medical Center. For years, I was the vice chairman of medicine, the program director in cardiology. I directed cardiovascular research. I built an entire research team, brought in millions of dollars of grants. And then COVID-19 hit. And my career at Baylor Scott & White was brought to the end in January when I was walked into a room by two administrators saying, "Your contract is done and turn in your badge." And that was the end of January. And when I asked what the reason was, the answer is no reason. None. You're done.
That
And
was
I could tell
January of this year.
one way of this year, and I can tell you the only thing that had happened during that time is I had treated COVID-19 patients successfully. I had published critical papers in this area. The only thing that happened, that was before we even knew there was a problem with the vaccines. So that would, had nothing to do with vaccination. That was simply due to the fact that I think because I treated patients early, I had a
And you
separation
spoke out against the narrative.
against the narrative of therapeutic nihilism. Remember, the narrative is don't do anything, let patients die. That was the narrative, and I found it absolutely morally and ethically unacceptable. So I signed a separation agreement, settlement agreement. I had to sit out of the hospital for nearly 2 months. I ended up recertifying in medicine, transferring my patients, did telemedicine, tried to keep patchwork, keep my practice going, transferred it to Hart Place. I still did stay in the same center. I went from the first floor in one building to the fifth floor in the other building. Successfully got over there, continued to work, and then this menace of the vaccine kept coming, and I could not stay silent as Americans were dying and being injured with these genetic platform vaccines, which, as we've discussed, has become a menace for America.
Wow. That and then that I mean that's just shocking to it. You know, at one level it's shocking to me. At another level it's not. I mean, they just want to make an example of you. You know, Peter, I mean they just do. I mean, the fact that your heart is in the right place, that you want to take care of patients and this early treatment is so important, and the fact that you were able to stand up with your incredible, impeccable credentials of your cardiology, your epidemiology background, that you can read the studies, you know these things are happening, and yet you would dare to stand up and stand out against the narrative. I mean, it's just like everything that we talked about on our previous interview, it's just so nefarious. And let's just call it out what it is. It's evil. It's just evil that's marching across the planet. And you, as a good man, was willing to stand up and stand against that, and that they are coming to kind of retaliate against you for that.
You can't make these things up. Patients, there are hospital presidents that are my patients, CEOs, doctors seek me out. I just had clinic the last couple of days. Probably half my patients flew from out of town. They got plane flights to see me. And I said, well, why are you here? They said, I want you to be my doctor. I can't trust my doctor anymore. Americans, half of Americans sense that something really bad is going on. And it seems to be centered on the vaccine. They sense some type of cloud that's come over the world. And right now, the menace is the vaccine. The respiratory illness, honestly, is not no longer the issue. That's easily treatable. The vaccine has become the menace. And my life has taken a turn. Last week, a major lawsuit was announced against me. It was actually announced in the newspapers, in the press, before I was even served court papers. I was trying to take care of patients, and I got a call. My wife is calling me. By the way, they're suing you. I had to scramble two sets of attorneys to try to show up in a hearing in an hour. They gave me less than an hour to show in a hearing. I said, what's the charges? What am I guilty of? You're guilty of by associating your name with your former employer, Baylor Scott & White Health System. I said, well, it's a health system. They own hospitals. I'm still on staff at these hospitals. My clinic is in one of the hospital buildings. It's kind of hard not to be associated. And really, like, what is the basis of this lawsuit? What crime did I commit? Did I violate some other term? No. Did I keep my medical staff privileges, licenses? No. Grants, keep my research team going? Although that's fine. It was this associational thing. So we did a quick dive. There's 800,000 legacy profiles on me and the internet. One of them is from the Cardiometabolic Health Conference. That's a Boston Harvard conference of which I presented 2 years ago on issues of heart and kidney disease. Really? A legacy profile 2 years ago is now an issue? There's 800,000. Anybody prominent in medicine keeps hundreds of thousands of various profiles. Other people keep them for me. Do you know somebody's made a Wikipedia page for me? I didn't even know it. They didn't ask my permission. Has
And
all
here's
kinds
what's
of
going to be interesting about this, Peter. Go in and try to modify your own Wikipedia page. They won't allow it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we've gone in to try to modify my Wikipedia page. And I was told by somebody who actually works at Wikipedia that they actually have a list of, and it's probably all done electronically on certain Wikipedia pages that if somebody goes in and tries to modify it, there's an alert that comes up, and somebody who works for Wikipedia goes back in and changes what was there. So as soon as they start calling you, the tinfoil hat conspiracy theory doctor who thinks that COVID can be treated prior to being in the hospital and has something negative to say about the vaccines, believe me, try to go in and change it. You won't be able to do it.
I've already gone in a couple of times because the lawsuit made me look at, well, what's out there on me? I wasn't paying attention to a lot of what's out there. So Wikipedia came up. So I took a look at it. I did try to make some changes. In fact, they are citing a fact checker. The fact checker is somebody who works for some fact check organization that's probably funded through nefarious sources. And they are literally fact checking my sworn testimony and my opinions. My opinions are not fact checkable. These are my opinions. And in fact, the person who did it was Texas Senate testimony. It's done by somebody in France. In France, why is somebody in France hunting me down for my Texas Senate one? Another one is a woman from mainland China who's in Hong Kong who was attacking me on something else. And it's just about my opinions. And in matter of fact, what they're fact checking me on is my opinion is that natural immunity is more robust than vaccine immunity. And I think I'm supported by the data, but it's an opinion. They are saying that Dr. McCullough made dangerous, false, and misleading claims. And they have a whole section on me in Wikipedia about COVID misinformation. Now, this is important because the Federation of State Medical Boards has announced they're going to start hunting doctors for misinformation and start taking away their licenses. And I bet you and I are at the top of the list. This is scary. This is so similar to Nazi Germany, we might as well call it.
You might as well call it because you're absolutely right. And it is, I've found that the more heat that I get, like I'm under, when I gave my testimony at the Ohio representatives that they were trying to move forward a bill, I went down to testify. The bill was, at the time, was H.R. 248. I think the number's been changed now. And really, their bill only said two things, really. One was it would prohibit employers from requiring COVID shots. Let me restate that. Employers could not fire someone for not getting a COVID shot, was basically what that bill was about. And the second part, Ohio has is one of the 16 or so remaining states that has a philosophical exemption to, for schools, for going into schools. So the parents say, I've looked at the risk of the shots, I've looked at the risk of needles, I'm going to go on giving my kid vitamins and keeping them healthy. Most people don't know that. And so the other part of the bill was that parents had a right to know that that according to Ohio law, they could legally opt out. That was all the bill was. And there were more than 1,000 businesses here in the state of Ohio that were against that bill. They want to have the right to fire people who don't get the COVID shot. 1,000 businesses. And so when I went down to testify for that, at the end of my testimony, I've already been up there for like an hour. At the end, they asked me if I had seen any unusual symptoms. And I said, well, yeah, I mean, you've seen a few. I mean, I'm sure all of you, and I couch this as a premise, I'm sure all of you have seen the pictures of people across the internet that have keys and forks and things, all they look all magnetic. I said, we don't have any idea what that is, but it's pretty interesting. Some people believe it may be associated with metals in the vaccine. Some people believe it may have something to do with 3G, 4G, 5G. We don't really know, but it seems to be a pretty unusual symptom, and a lot of people have it. Well, the mainstream media ripped that out, and across 1,000 media outlets, said, I was telling my senators that everybody had now become magnetized by these shots. Took everything out of context of what I said. I couched it as a, it's pretty interesting. There's a lot out there. We don't have an answer to it. We have no idea what's causing it. So for me, whenever, and I share this with you as a colleague and somebody who's now being dragged through the mud for probably the first time in your life with your impeccable credentials, and everything that you've done has been so above board and positive for humanity in your career. Having been drugged through the mud a few times, it always takes me back to when I was about 7 years old. And my mom said to me, sticks and stones can break your bones, but names can never hurt you. And so it gave me a little bit of a tougher shell on top of that. And I know that the more that they drag me through the mud, the more I am right hovering right over the target. Then they are doing that to you because with your impeccable credentials and all the amazing things that you've done for patients and academia, you're a real threat to them because you have the credentials and the brain power and all of the background of your epidemiology to look at their stuff and say the emperor has no clothes. And
You know,
so that's what makes you a big threat.
yeah, as the patients pour in to see me, I continue to publish and make great progress. My wife and I are the largest physician donors that I'm aware of to the entire health system foundation. We have an endowed scholarship at Baylor University, just 90 minutes south of us. You can't imagine the outcry and the outrage from patients and people in the community and donors. Of how can you do this to your leading physician? How can you do this? And you know what the health system has done, Baylor Scott & White Health System? They have actually hired outside counsel. So they have a mountain of lawyers. They always handle doctor contracts internally. They've hired outside counsel. That means they are willing to spend some dollars or they've received some dollars to really make this happen. Let's actually try to destroy this person. Let's do a press release before he even knows about the lawsuit. Let's put the lawsuit at a dollar figure that can absolutely terrify him and his family. I'm trying to pay tuition right now.
Yep. It's so don't, as the expression goes, don't let the bastards get you down. God's on your side. Stay close to him. When times get tough, that's when we know that we need to get closer to God. Get your head in the Word of God. And in all of those 365 verses that say, fear not, trust me, they're there for a reason. Fear not, trust me. You're doing the right things. You're standing up for your patients. You've come up with incredible protocols that all of the rest of us are using. You've done the right things in academia. You're going to come down on the right side of history, Peter. So
I
just
think
maintain that,
you've made a great point, Dr. Tenpenny. This is about coming down on the right side of history. This basically boils down to right and wrong. This boils down to good versus evil. This boils down to human ethics, morals,
Yeah.
ethics, clinical indications, contraindications. This is as clean as it gets. And I can tell you, I've had an outpouring of support. My last weekend, I've never received so many attorney calls in my life. And you know what an attorney's saying? Listen, you just let me know when you want to start the countersuit because it's going to be big. And whatever they think they're going to do, they are flush with cash. These health systems have made a fortune with COVID-19. They have denied all the early treatment. They've had patients for these prolonged hospital stays. It's been absolutely abominable what they've done. And you know what? They're going to hit me and they're going to pay.
Amen, brother. Absolutely. And I mean that with all sincerity. Yes. And I think that you're going to have a lot of people that are going to, not only people, but other physicians. And like you said, other lawyers are rallying behind you because what you are doing, and, we started our first conversation today. And I said, how did you decide to step out behind the curtain, so to speak? Because all the rest of our fellow physician colleagues are all cowering in the corner for whatever reason. They just are. They're not treating their patients appropriately. They're not willing to speak out against this travity that's going on. And at the end of the day, this information and what you're doing and being and stepping into the role of leadership, you're going to be on the right side of history. So
Thank
I
you.
want to respect your time today, and I want to thank you so much for this additional information that we've done for our deep dive. One more time, and really importantly, and kind of slowly, so everybody can get this, how is the best way that we can support you? I mean, obviously, you're a man with great brain power, but you've got a great heart too. You've got a heart for your patients and heart for humanity and for your family. And so we want to be able to get behind you and do as much as we can to support you.
Well, Truth for Health. Truth for Health Foundation has just been formed. Dr. Lee Vliet is the leader. Truth for Health Foundation. We're having our press conference tomorrow, August 4th, at 11 a.m. Central, 12 noon. There's a donate section. If you put donate and you put in honor of, put McCullough, it'll go in the right direction. And if I prevail, which I will, I'll be able to more than supplant that amount. We can use it to help others. Because I got to tell you, every hero doctor now in the United States, every hero that's tried to help somebody, their license is going to be on the line.
Yep.
And that's going to be the next wave because this dark force is going to try to expunge every bit of good that we have in our country.
And you had mentioned you have a podcast and a newsletter. Where can we find those?
So the podcast and the newsletter are an America Out Loud talk radio, The McCullough Report. I put it together every week. I interview experts from around the world. It's one of the great things. Americans are getting no viewpoint from doctors outside the United States. I've had people from Brazil and France and some of the real leaders all over the world giving people a different viewpoint. And we're focusing on COVID-19. We're focusing on early treatment and vaccine safety. And we brought in regulatory experts. It's all exposed. Everything is highly cited. And I hope the listeners get some insight on this. The mainstream media right now is done. They are under the a very strong threat of the trusted news service. There's not going to be any fair information getting out. The people of the United States are going to get the information through shows like yours and from these important other sources of media.
They absolutely are. Well, thank you so much again. I'm so grateful and so honored to learn so many things about you. I mean, I love doing these deep dives because it takes the academic physician and it shows who you are as a real human being with a real heart and a real fighter and a real warrior inside of you. So it's so grateful for spending you with this time. And so we will definitely be following up in the show notes below. We'll put all of your links to all these different places so that we can get behind you and support you. And with that, I close every one of my broadcasts, whether it's by either recorded or live, with one of my favorite verses from the Bible, Romans 12, 12, rejoice in hope, be patient in trouble, and be persistent in prayer. So until the next time, remember to lean in to God, trust him for everything, small and large. He will never let you down, and he'll always be behind you. And you've got truth and God on your side, Dr. Peter McCullough. So thank you so much. Thank you for everybody who's been listening to this today. Out, and we'll see you in the next time. Bye for now.